You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, our three-day-old addition to the Monocle 24 lineup, coming to you live from Midori House and just down the road also from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Russia denounces the UN's Syrian chemical weapons report. Robert Fox and James Boyes tell us why Moscow refuses to lay any blame at Assad's door. Then we ask how international BFFs can spy on each other without breaking up.
All the attempts of getting relations back on track after there was some falling out during the presidency of President Dilma Rousseff's predecessor have gone completely derailed after this.
Later in the show, we talk women's rights in Egypt with documentary filmmaker Hanan Abdallah.
In that day-to-day life, the parameters of their freedom is very clear, and the way that they resist and push against them is even clearer. And for me, that was what was very interesting.
And as every day on Aperitivo, we'll stop by the Monocle Cafe for coffee and a chat. Today, the creative brains behind Japanese brand United Arrows explains the key to their success.
Our mission is to always keep their fantasy side, and also providing the realistic side for them. So the quality and service is so important.
All that, plus music, and a look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's right now on Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. So get prepared, because there's lots coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Six people have been killed in a collision between a double-decker bus and a passenger train in the Canadian capital, Ottawa. 31 people were injured, 11 are said to be in a critical condition. The accident happened on a crossing during morning rush hour. Officials say all the dead and injured were on board the bus. Robert Evrere saw the accident.
Just waiting for the train, and I was looking down the track. The train was coming east to west, and next thing you know, I see the train coming and the light disappeared in the train, and I just seen the debris flying, and wasn't much of a sound, but then the train started to slide to its right and black smoke was coming up.
The United Nations says a report by chemical weapons experts which concluded that sarin had been used in an attack in Syria is indisputable. The spokesman said the report was thoroughly objective and its findings spoke for themselves. Russia has dismissed the report as preconceived and tainted by politics. It's questioned whether the likes of France and the United States have proof that President Assad's forces were responsible. And Moscow says Syria has handed it evidence that rebel forces have used chemical weapons. The UN report did not assign blame, but NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says he's in no doubt that government forces were responsible. Speaking after meeting the British Prime Minister David Cameron in Downing Street, he said it's essential to ensure full and effective implementation of the Russian-American plan for Syria's chemical weapons to be handed over to international control. And he said military action against Syria should remain an option.
In the case of non-compliance, we will need a very firm international response. I do believe that the credible threat of military action was the reason why diplomacy got a chance. And I think in order to keep momentum in the diplomatic and political process, the military option should still be on the table.
The US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the Pentagon will be reviewing security clearance in the wake of the Washington Navy Yard shooting in which 12 people were shot dead by an IT subcontractor working there. Mr. Hagel says he's putting his deputy in charge of in-depth reviews of US military security worldwide. Following the country's latest mass shooting, President Obama has called on politicians from all sides to work together to push through new background checks for gun ownership. A Hong Kong couple has been jailed for torturing, beating and abusing their Indonesian maid over a 2-year period until she escaped last October. 30-year-old Kartika Puspitasari was beaten with a bicycle chain and suffered burns to her face and arms after a hot iron was held against her. She said her employers once put a nappy on her and tied her to a chair for 5 days while they went on holiday. Her male employer was jailed for 3 years, 3 months, his wife for 5.5 years. Cynthia Kaabdanteles, General Manager of Mission for Migrant Workers, says abuse of domestic servants is a huge problem in Hong Kong.
In any given year from the previous years, we get between 800 to 1,500 cases a year. Now, at this point, we have like more than 1,000 already. At this point of the year, we haven't finished the whole year yet. And it's not yet the last quarter of the year. So it's serious.
The Italian Coast Guard says a patrol boat has rescued a group of 210 migrants found stranded in a large dinghy around 70 miles south of Lampedusa. The rescue took place on Tuesday night after Italian Coast Guard spotted the migrants' vessel crammed with presumed asylum seekers, including women, children and babies. This was one of 5 boatloads of migrants the Coast Guard has rescued during a 24-hour period. The 5 boats were carrying almost 1,000 people from Africa, Syria and Egypt. Organisers of the Man Booker Prize say that in 2014 it'll be open to English writing authors from all over the world. At the moment, only writers from Britain, the Commonwealth, Ireland and Zimbabwe are eligible for the £50,000 prize. The Booker Foundation says the step has not been taken quickly or lightly, but some experts say they've made a commercial decision and American novelists could now dominate the prize. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. So does that worry you that an American might win the Booker Prize?
As long as the best writer wins, I'm not too bothered. But, you know, I'd like to wave the flag for dear old Blighty.
Well, you kind of do need it. I think what's quite good about these awards are occasionally they're a little bit nationalistic. They do kind of put the spotlight on some homegrown talent or, in our case, the Commonwealth talent. But if we compete with America, we may not stand a chance.
Well, there are a lot more of them. Let's hope it doesn't get like the Eurovision Song Contest, where it's all political.
I know, and poor old Britain doesn't stand a chance then. Thank you very much. And of course, Barney's going to be back at the bottom of the hour with more headlines. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Buenos Aires.
To Zurich.
Hong Kong,
to Toronto,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo. The time here is now 18:08 in London, which means it's 02:08 in the morning in Tokyo, and it's 13:08 in New York. It's time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me here in the studio with their take on the news are Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard in London, and Dr. James Boyes, a visiting research fellow at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Robert, a very busy time for a defence editor. You've probably never been busier.
Yes, I try to avoid being over busy about this. I'm being quite frank, and it sounds terribly facetious, because you can get bombarded with detail, and just the tons and tons of stuff that is falling out of the sky about Syria, and you have to be very careful. You have to go to the ground as much as you possibly can, because a lot of the stuff that's coming from London, New York, Paris, and above all Washington is completely misguiding as to what appears to be happening. It's complex. And when you say it's a wicked complex problem, I didn't realise this is it means that it's impacted and is unsolvable. Let's call it really a knotty puzzle, which is a resolvable problem. And this is what's going to happen. But could I just say, I think you talk, you know, that from the 18th century and even before, you've talked about a revolution, the diplomatic revolution of Westminster and so on before the Seven Years' War and things like that. I think we've been through that in the last few weeks. And there's a very serious change. For all the claims, quite shrewdly, of Russia about American exceptionalism and how it sees itself as the unique military hyperpower is very different now from where it was a month ago.
Is that something that you'd concur with, James?
I think we have to try and put things in perspective. There's no doubt that Barack Obama has made some very, very interesting choices. I think he's really made a rod for his own back. I've heard people try and explain this to me. It's, oh, well, you know, blah, 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 the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I say, yeah, yeah. But the one thing that JFK did do during the Cuban Missile Crisis was to make sure that he didn't paint himself or Nikita Khrushchev into a corner and always gave himself a way out of things. And what you see in the White House starting 12 months ago is Barack Obama inadvertently painting himself into a corner with his red line remark, which he must rue the day he ever said. And as he and his colleagues have been trying to back out of that and hem and haw, you know, and it's reminiscent for those of us who can remember when Clinton was denying talk of genocide and saying, oh, no, 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 it's acts of genocide because it's a semantic way out of doing something. You know, when you see how the administration coming into the second term has had to change gear because it's brought on people like Samantha Power, for example, and Susan Rice, who've got a very, very different take on things than their predecessors. And so Obama's had to sort of go along with that. But you have to ask the question, who is setting policy in the White House? Because it seems that the administration officials are running the show and that you end up with rhetoric ahead of policy.
They're missing Hillary Clinton like mad.
Because you think that's the vacuum,
yes, Kerry is no substitute, because there's something about his bawling, braying, masculine approach which is really not working, and she is just appearing, almost backing into the limelight. She was getting a degree at St Andrews University, and there was a good old Hillary. Hillary's a street fighter, as indeed was Bill. And what I think the world is saying, what the world allied to America is saying. We want precisely, as we just heard, practicality. It is so wildly impractical, everything that they're saying at the moment. And that it's not that they're misspeaking. The lofty words are there, okay, but it's actually the missteps on the ground. And the way, with such an elegant, almost a chess move, that Putin, by putting that article in the New York Times, and then rather sadly, supporters of Barack Obama and even further to the right, necessarily Republican supporters, having to parse it factually, line by line. Too bad. It had gone and it had got out there and it scored one or two really serious points.
James, I want to just bring something in here. Just today, we've seen the Russians saying, you know, this is a quote from them, that they're disappointed, to put it mildly, about the approach taken by the UN Secretariat and the UN inspectors who prepared their report. This is on the gas attack. Mm-hmm. They claim selectively and incompletely. Again, they're trying to change the news agenda. They're trying to, you know, And it is interesting whether it's denial or belief, but they're not budging from Assad's side. Do you feel that they have now the wind behind them? They feel that they can even now kind of, you know, turn around a UN report. As Robert was saying, America seems to be dithering, doesn't quite know how to control the news agenda even on this.
Yeah, I think if you look at this, I think most people in the West would have read the headlines, you know, the UN finds chemical weapons were used, you know, follow up by, oh, and by the way, Pope still Catholic. I mean, it's just remarkable. The fact that the Russians are able to spin this and continue it out into the near future. I mean, we were talking before we came on air. It's very much in the Russian perspective now to keep this just ticking along, ticking along, ticking along, because the longer it does, it keeps Assad in power. It keeps his foot on the throat, effectively, of any uprising against it. And what it does is it greatly lessens what George Herbert Walker Bush used to call the big mo, the momentum towards war that was gearing up and gearing up and gearing up. And that's been completely lost now in the West, both in Westminster and in the White House. So no one is expecting anybody to return to Parliament or to Congress anytime soon with any call for arms. And the longer the Russians can spill this out, the better for them. I mean, coming back to something that that Robert was saying, you know, people talk about the Clinton years, and I'm writing a book on it at the moment. And what's remarkable is the amount of people who served under both Bill and now under Barack Obama. And what it demonstrates, I think, is the importance of presidential leadership, because say what you will about Bill Clinton, and he's been the butt of enough jokes, but he ran a pretty tight ship when it came to foreign policy in the end. And there's so much that's going on now with regards to Syria that echoes what happened with Bosnia. The idea that the West wanted to get involved, they tried to go through the UN, they were stymied by doing so by, guess who, the Russians. And Clinton found a way to do it. And Obama has categorically gone in the opposite direction and said, I'm going to reject executive power leadership and throw this into the long grass of Congress. And he's doing great irreparable damage, not only to his presidency, but to the power of the presidency. And if you want anything to reinforce this, just look at Joe Klein's piece in Time magazine this week, because it's absolutely devastating attack upon the Obama administration.
Robert, is there any risk here for Russia, though? Because the interesting thing is, if in the broader public mind it does stick that Russia was responsible for this gas attack, then, you know, Putin, Syria was responsible for this gas attack, then you are suddenly left with Russia completely having bolted its kind of, you know, its reputation. And the Russians may be a bit kind of tougher going than this on the Americans, but they certainly don't want to be seen backing a man who gassed his own people, do they?
I think we're being, it sounds very callous what I'm about to say next. We're getting hung up on the gas too much, and a lot of rubbish has been talked about this. The most egregious attack since Halabja. It's absolutely untrue, because there were more egregious attacks than Halabja, even, on the Central Front in the Iran-Iraq War. There are various people, Robert Kaplan and people, have been writing about it, seeing these things, seeing the young Iranians. It happened on both sides, but particularly with Saddam Hussein, and I do wonder where he got his materials for this from, and seeing these young Iranians on the Alfor Peninsula in the pools of water, floating upside down, completely floating face up, completely unmarked. It's been around. Look, what's going on with Russia is real politics, but it's not a joke for them. It's not a black sort of Jack Nicholson type Joker joke. It's because it is absolutely existential for them. They must support Assad for as long as they possibly can, as they must feel out to Hezbollah, as they must feel out even to, particularly now that they've got Rouhani and his new team in Iran. They are realistic about it, because the subtext you can see from Putin is so clear. They are very worried about an al-Qaeda essence being in Syria. And I think that that is extremely extremely likely. And whether they control the whole of Syria or only part of it is quite clear, particularly from the report from Jaynes this week, very well thought through, that the Nusra Front and the movement for the state of Islam in Iraq and Mesopotamia, however you parse that acronym, but it's obviously in Arabic, they are the dominant force in the insurgency. You have had rubbish both from moderate Republicans and Obama supporters saying, well, let's, you know, if we gave the good guys, the secularists, enough weapons, they would overcome them. Where have we heard that kind of nonsense before? It is absolutely clear in this mélange, and it is a huge mélange of the insurgency, who is coming out on top, and it is extremely serious. We, by the way, also into this equation, and I think this is another thing that scares Russia very much, and the American commentariat hasn't been clear enough about it, is what is Israel's role in this? The thing that is absolutely clear, the most disappointed allies of the US were not France nor Britain, that the US didn't go ahead and launch Tomahawk missiles because of this gas attack. They're Turkey, on the one hand, and Israel, because Israel wanted America and its allies to smash up Hezbollah.
Okay, two things quickly, James. One, long game. Let's try and do this in quite succinctly. Russia only wins if Assad could stay in power. And that doesn't really seem likely, does it, in 2 or 3 years, that the world could go back to recognising him diplomatically and saying, OK, we forget everything that's happened?
Well, I think the problem is what's the alternative? I mean, if we decided that no one's going to go in to remove him, who else is going to do it? It's quite clear that he's now in the ascendancy within the civil war that's fighting. And with respect, the guy isn't going to walk away from power. Why would he? So if the Russians basically just keep doing what they're doing and block any moves at the UN, don't forget what plays into this is that Putin has a great advantage in terms of he's playing a power politic game and Obama's playing a short-term, parlor game almost. Barack Obama will be out of office in 3 years' time. People are already talking about him being a lame duck. We're already talking about the midterms in 14 and people talking about Hillary in 16. So you enter into the American democratic domestic political cycle, at which point nothing will get done, because it's been demonstrated that as soon as you enter into the electoral cycle, foreign policy just stops. So as soon as Assad can get to, I would say, 2014, he's safe and going to carry on in office as long as he wants.
And again, succinctly, just picking up on Robert's very important point there about Israel, what we're seeing also going on in Washington is this courting of Rouhani suddenly. He's, you know, that they're kind of keener to kind of see what he'll do. Today they've released, I think, 7 political prisoners in Tehran. It seems to be a warm-up act going to the before he heads to the UN. Mm. Do you think America's hoping that actually out of this, it can nudge Iran slightly away from Russia?
Well, I think that one has to question where the overtures are coming from, because there's certainly been some interesting suggestions that it's coming out of Tehran and not Washington. And I don't know necessarily that what any rapprochement comes about, we can say, well, it's all because of Obama. I mean, Obama did come in and say, well, we'll sit down. But it's certainly not, as I understand it, coming out of Washington. It's coming out of Tehran.
Agreed.
Yeah, and as a result of that, you've got to say, well, what on earth has been the benefit of Obama's, you know, sort of rapprochement with the world? It doesn't seem to have gotten anywhere. If anything comes out of the Syrian thing with regard to Tehran, fantastic. But any benefit has not come about because of any diplomatic moves from Washington, as far as I can see.
Gentlemen, we're going to have a short pause, but then we've got plenty more to be talking about in this first half hour of Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, because today I'm joined by Robert Fox from the Evening Standard and James Boyes from King's College London. As I said, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how you spy on your friends.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. And still with me are Robert Fox, defence editor of the London Evening Standard, and also Dr. James Boyes, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. Gentlemen, the next topic we're going to talk about is what's been happening again involving Washington. Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian president, has cancelled her state visit to Washington. She's fed up that people in Washington have been spying on her, or so she claims. But first of all, let's just hear this clip. This is a Brazilian journalist based here in London who works for the BBC, Bruno Garces, and this was him speaking a little bit earlier with Andrew Muller and Marcus Hippie.
Well, I think it is genuine anger. This story has resonated deeply in Brazil because not only her personal correspondence, her personal emails, President Dilma Rousseff's, were spied upon, but also those of related to the state-owned oil company Petrobras, which is a strategic company, considered to be a strategic company for Brazil. So I think all the attempts of getting relations back on track after there was some falling out during the presidency of President Dilma Rousseff's predecessor, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, have gone completely derailed after this.
How far back do you think this has bumped relations between Brasilia and Washington? Because in the last two decades especially, there's been a fairly general thaw, I think, between South and North America, as opposed to the way things were between the 50s and 80s, when the whole South and Central America was still a Cold War battleground and the North was regarded as the enemy. The relationship has to recover. Brazil and the US cannot be on non-speaking terms forever. How long do you think it will take?
Well, I think it'll be a tense relationship for the time being, but Brazil and the US have relationships on several fronts. I mean, ironically, Brazil and the US are partners, are co-founders of an institution called the Open Government Partnership, which its core objective is to disclose information on governments, on opening governments, and disclosing information on public officials. So for the U.S. to do that against one of its main partners, and it wasn't only Brazil, it was Mexico as well, strikes a little bit as odd, to say the least.
So what are we waiting for now to happen when it comes to waiting for the relations to improve? Does the time heal or does someone have to apologize?
That's what Brazil is expecting. That's what President Dilma is expecting, an explanation followed by an apology.
Well, Robert, you're already saying that poor President Obama is having a bit of a bad week, as it were, with Syria, but this doesn't help. But do you think it's serious?
I think it's a wonderful thing. I was thinking it's pretty V.S. Naipaul isn't around to write it up. This is a colossal fan dance. President Rousseff must know that this goes on. And do you mean to say nothing, nowhere, ever in academe or commerce spies on anything American from Brazil? It's an open market. This is what we have learned from Snowden, and we've learned from Bradley Manning. As a great friend of mine, who was the first UK assistant chief of the defense staff in charge of cyber, Major General now retired, Jonathan Shaw, he was kind of short-toured because he told the British government, if you think cyber can be made secure forever and a day, forget about it. It's an open market. And I think that's really what we're beginning to learn from all of this. The problem is that these revelations do bring people down. I mean, this is how, through a Wikipedia leak, WikiLeaks leak being produced in the press in Lebanon, that brought the Ben Ami regime to an end in Tunisia, with hot gossip too about him and his hairdresser wife. And I think it will go on. You know, nothing is private in cyberspace.
James, is it naivety on the part of Gilma, or is it even kind of a bit Shakespearean? The lady doth protest too much. Is she up to the same kind of things as well?
Well, I think it's naivety on everybody's behalf. Let's be honest. What have we learned from Manning, Snowden and Assange? Well, guess what? The United States spies on people. Guess what? Everybody spies on everybody. You know, you look at all these embassies that are around the world. They're not just there to sort of like dish out passports. They're there to act as intelligence gathering bases for all nations in all countries. You go back to the 1990s, the Americans had CIA agents kicked out of France for industrial espionage. This is nothing new. The fact that America is at odds with its neighbors in the South, well, great. That's a great surprise. Ultimately, this is just a. It's also an example, I think, though. It does say something about the fact that the head of Brazilian can basically shortchange the United States at the last minute. It's not great. I think it's a sign of the reduced authority of the President of the United States on the world stage, both as an individual and partly as an office. But ultimately, you know, as Robert rightly points out, you know, Brazil needs the United States. The United States needs Brazil. This will work itself out. It's just a diplomatic snafu effect. But the problem is,
it's like in real life, when you have a fight with somebody, and if you storm out the room, the embarrassing thing is you kind of have to go back at some point. And Robert, do you think that she's got that kind of moment awaiting where she actually has to say, don't worry about it?
The little girl at the back of the class being shouting about the bully and running out of the room in tears. Yes, there is an element of that. But I think there's an element of something with Obama. Sorry, it's Kick Obama Day here. But the thing is that I'm fed up as a hack. Always reading about Obama's rhetoric. It's never his rhetoric, by the way. It's either his soaring rhetoric or his lofty rhetoric. And I think he's got a real problem with it. He's a bit of a moralist. And the fact is, for the moral voice, it doesn't quite work. And it's particularly when we hear a very practical, very down-to-earth, quite flawed by his own confession, moral voice. One of the new factors, he hasn't really emerged yet, but is beginning to, is the Pope. And this is why, you know, the Pope preaches, but he also does a hell of a lot. And, you know, that the impact of his visit on Brazil, I think, was enormously important. It was unexpectedly successful. And I think that here's a man who uses plain language and probably says what he means. What they're worried about with the soaring rhetoric or the lofty rhetoric, the high oratory of Mr. Obama is what's behind it. And it's very, very interesting. I think that there might be more more calculation behind this. She must be pretty confident. She wants to put a bit of salt on his tail at the moment. And it may be, rather like Putin again, a very clever move.
Now, James, just before we almost wrap up, Snowden has certainly been kind of setting the news agenda every week. There's something else that's leaked. Do you think that there's a lot more dirt to come from him? And because it's a bit like Assange, it does begin to kind of shake actually how different governments see each other. And even if it's only out in public, they have to act on it, it seems.
Yeah, I think that one of the issues you've got here, and this, I think one of the reasons it's drummed out is because it's almost become a media on media story. As long as The Guardian are running this, it's in their sort of readership issue to keep eking this out. So I think that Grenwald will keep...
Well, you mean it's like the Daily Express and the Diana conspiracies?
I couldn't possibly comment, but yes, absolutely. I think one of the great things is, coming back briefly to Robert's point about Obama's soaring rhetoric, he's great when he's talking on auto-cue, and as soon as you get him off that, he gets into all sorts of messes, and as soon as he ad-libs, he walks into a red line issue, and it's caused him the biggest problems of his presidency.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we definitely need the two of you back very soon and together.
Is that a red line, by any chance?
No, red light, maybe.
Maybe a red line. That was great. That was Robert Fox, who's the defence editor of the Evening Standard here in London, and Dr. James Boyes, who's the visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. Thank you very much for joining us here today to unpack some of those big stories.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to chat with the creative mind behind Japanese brand United Arrows. We'll talk women's rights in Egypt with documentary filmmaker Hanan Abdallah. And we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia on Monocle Daily. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Six people have been killed in a collision between a double-decker bus and a passenger train in the Canadian capital, Ottawa. 31 people were injured. 11 are said to be in a critical condition. The United Nations says a report by chemical weapons experts, which concluded that sarin had been used in an attack in Syria, is indisputable. Russia has dismissed the report as preconceived and tainted by politics. The US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the Pentagon will be reviewing security clearance in the wake of the Washington Navy Yard shooting in which 12 people were shot dead by an IT subcontractor working there. A Hong Kong couple has been jailed for torturing, beating and abusing their Indonesian maid over a two-year period until she escaped. She was beaten with a bicycle chain and suffered burns to her face and arms after a hot iron was pressed against her. She said she was also once put in a nappy and tied to a chair for 5 days while her employers went on holiday. The Italian Coast Guard says a patrol boat has rescued a group of 210 migrants stranded in a large dinghy around 70 miles south of Lampedusa. This is one of 5 boatloads of migrants who've been rescued during a 24-hour period. The boats were carrying almost 1,000 people. And organisers of the Man Booker Prize say that in 2014 it'll be open to English writing authors from all over the world. At the moment, only writers from Britain, the Commonwealth, Ireland and Zimbabwe are eligible for the £50,000 prize. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. It was interesting hearing the gentleman talk there about the soaring oratory of Obama. Do you find it quite difficult sometimes when you see stuff coming up on Reuters and things that people do bolt these words together and they're quite hard to break?
Well, I see the text of some of the things they say and it looks all right. And then it takes about half an hour to say something which is just a few words because of all the pauses and the ums and ers. And you try to edit them down to a manageable size. And of course, sometimes that disrupts the natural speech rhythms.
Well, I think Barney's got great oratory. I won't say it's soaring because that seems to have become a bit of a bad word around here.
It's a bit
here.
Of a sore.
Yeah, a bit of a sore. Well, thank you very much, Barney. Barney, of course, will be back in another 27 minutes with another roundup of all the world news. But welcome back to Aperitivo. It's only day 3 of the show and it's coming live here at from Midori House. The time now is 18:33 here in London, which means it's 21:33 in Moscow and 13:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Now, each day on Aperitivo, we'll be leaving the comfortable confines of Studio One and heading down to the equally cosy Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street. Today, Monocle's fashion editor Takaharu Satou speaks with Hirofumi Kurino, senior advisor for creative direction at United Arrows, the powerhouse Japanese brand and retailer. I kind of think upmarket store. Can one on every corner somehow. How does that work? Anyway, he was in town for London Fashion Week and he tells us how it's been going so far.
Our company is a retail company. So we're always looking for the interesting production and new talent and the good quality. And London Fashion Week becomes more and more important, interesting. So I have a chance to come here, so why not join London Fashion Week? And not all the show I saw, I should say just a few show I saw. But even with this 5-6 show, I feel it's changing. It's changing drastically.
So talking about some brands you discovered this time, or the brands you got impressed with.
One big thing for me is my friend, Paola Gelbaze of 1205. They do the first runway show in London. And they have their brand like 2-3 years. And before I saw the show, I never think they're the type of the doing runway show. More intimate, quiet, person-to-person type of the brand. But by this chance, they're showing in a small runway, and it makes sense. I was surprised, and even they're surprised. So it is a very good discovery that to doing the runway show is pull out something from your mind. It's like when you're a child, suddenly you're casting as the in some theater, and suddenly you found you have a talent to sing and dance. So maybe it's a little bit similar situation like this. They didn't know that they have this kind of dimension of showing their collection and also re-concept their collection. So this is a very typical case, and also I knew them very well. But maybe this is going to be a kind of a good example of give the people chance to show in a public and to renew yourself, revitalize yourself. So this is a very interesting experience.
So obviously, we all have to talk about this like a recession, and our country, Japan, has been in recession like since a few decades, over 2 decades. And then how do you observe this market, especially your market? Would the people still be buying the new things? Do they have a consumer appetite for the new things on the shop floor level? How do you analyze?
I should say our company's case is special, but happily we have a very good season. We are very positive. And of course, with the new government's new strategy, the general economy itself is uprising, but still the people's fantasy for fashion is a little bit going down if I compare to the 80s and 90s. But it means not only fashion, but also people are much careful about spending money. So they take care of their life, they take care of their family, but take less take care of the fashion. But maybe for you it sounds strange, but as a retailer, this is a very healthy situation, I think. Because if people buying too much, they fed up with the fashion itself. So our mission is to always keep their fantasy side, and also providing the realistic side for them. So the quality and service is so important. For example, this autumn-winter in our campaign is in Japanese, 情熱 接客, means let me dress you. So this is very simple, a kind of a game. Customer come to shop. Customer let the salesperson change your clothes totally. But you don't have to buy. Just change your clothes. We put the final style in Instagram or our website. So the other people can see how they change. And we called it, we change the world, you change the world, you change yourself. So this campaign we did last year, it was successful, but this is tremendous success. It's more than 30-50% people like to join this. And still we say, you don't have to buy this, just change your clothes. Otherwise, people are fed up with the consumering, and I don't think fashion is a consumering. So to exist as a healthy retailer, this kind of project is so important to communicate our customer and share our vision together.
Let me dress you. What a good idea that is. I want that. Every morning, actually, be a bit easier, wouldn't it? Well, that was Hirofumo Kurino. He's the creative brain behind the Japanese brand United Arrows. And he was talking to Monocle's fashion editor, Takaharu Sato, and they were down at the Monocle Cafe. So you should head down there too, because you can bump into our crew recording for this show, Aperitivo. After break, we're going to be talking with the Egyptian documentary filmmaker, Hanan Abdallah. That's right here on Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. So stay tuned.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
And welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, the threat of an impending strike on Syria has somewhat eclipsed news out of Egypt in recent weeks. But as the situation in Cairo remains uncertain and dangerous, it's worth looking back at the first days of the Egyptian revolution, a time when hopes were high for the people of Egypt, women in particular, and ask, where are we now? Documentary filmmaker Hanan Abdallah followed four women in the wake of the Egyptian spring, right after the 18 days of protest in Tahrir Square that led to the ousting of Hosni Mubarak. Her film, In the Shadow of a Man, draws the intimate and humorous portrait of a society where women's quest for independence mirrors that of the entire Egyptian society. Monocle producer Daphne Denis caught up with Abdallah at the screening of her documentary at the Frontline Club in London.
عارفة يعني ايه؟ يعني حتى لو هو غبي معاها مع الست دي تقاليد المصرية يقولك ايه اهو ده اللي راجل ولا ده اللي حيطة.
For me I was trying to tell the very personal stories, the very intimate stories that you hear amongst women every day in Egypt, that within them tell a lot about where the limits of their freedom are. For me, that was the most important thing because I feel like in that day-to-day life, the parameters of their freedom is very clear, and the way that they resist and push against them is even clearer. And for me, that was what was very interesting to hear. And I wasn't, when I started making the film, I didn't have a story I wanted to tell per se, except that I wanted to have a framework within which I could talk about women's issues that didn't position them as victimized and oppressed and not fighting back, but also to put it within the framework that their emancipation will come with the emancipation of society, and that you cannot isolate women's freedom from the reality of society itself. But apart from that, I was actually just trying to learn and hear their stories and how they felt towards them.
So can you take us through those stories? What are those stories?
أنا كان بيتقال لي أنت بنت زي الولد، أنت بنت زي الولد. كنت واخدة كل حقوقي كإنسانة يعني. ما حدش بيتحكم فيا.
Well, we have four characters in the film. Wafaa, who her main story, she's 69 in the film, and she divorced when she was 31, and she, you know, she defied her family's wishes and getting a divorce and wanted to live by herself, and then decided to travel the world to get work to be able to gain her freedom, and she now, well, she used to live in London, where she ended up staying and working. And then you have Shahinda, who is 70, and she is a very famous resistance figure in Egypt, and she, you know, she's seen the 1952 revolution, she's seen the women's movement in the 60s, and she's lived through the 25th of January revolution of 2011. And her story of resistance is to do with her choosing the man she wanted to marry, who was her husband Salah, who her mother refused for her to marry, and then they eloped. And he was a fighter for the peasants' rights in Egypt, and he was killed by the feudalists, and on the day of his death, she decides to take his place and to continue that fight, and that's what really gave her the strength to do so. With Badriya, she lives in the rural farmland of Almenia. She has five children, and she wanted to go to art school but never managed to fulfill her dream, and she lives in some kind of poverty in Egypt, and her main concern is that she wants to feed her family, and there are no jobs for her, no jobs for her husband, and she works so hard and has received so little appreciation for what she does, but all she cares about is her children, but she wants a better life for them all. And finally is Suzanne, who is 30 and unmarried. She's been engaged 6 times, and she tells a story of how her abuse actually in a way ended up liberating her, because she fought against this sexual abuse that happened within her own family and made her decide that she would never be put in a position where she was dependent on anyone else, and that she would fight for her emancipation, which is why she does. She's financially independent, she has her own shop, and it's made her be able to take so many more decisions in her life that she wants to take.
Can you maybe take us through what's happened to women in Egypt since then?
I mean, the truth of the situation is that the demands of the revolution for both men and women haven't been met, you know, which were bread, social justice and freedom and dignity. So obviously the condition for women in terms of actually de facto changes haven't changed on the ground in the last 2.5 years. But that's also because there hasn't been any social justice for anyone or any justice for anyone over the last 2.5 years. But the difference is, from before the 18 days and the beginning of the revolution thereafter, is there has been far more of a collective solidarity and bigger movements, grassroots movements that have been coming up as a result of what's been happening in these last 2.5 years, that has actually perhaps started to be the seeds of a wider women's movement in Egypt that we can see and continue to grow. You can see that with movements such as Apantish that happened, that started to group together after the wave of sexual assaults or gang rapes in political, you know, protest spheres like Tahrir, like Ittihadiyya, which is the presidential palace. And you can see that as well with, you know, the small protests that happened after there was that very iconic image of a woman being dragged by the army in December 2011 with the blue bra being stamped on. And from that there came a completely impromptu women's movement that came in protest against it, and it, you know, gather momentum. So those are the changes that I see, and I think there's more of a feeling of agency that has happened amongst everyone, and from that amongst women as well. That thing that which we gained during the first 18 days of the revolution, I think that's something that has stayed on very much so, and I really hope we don't lose it.
You're positive that the first Egyptian Spring had a positive impact on females' rights in Egypt?
I don't like to see it as the first revolution or the first spring. For me, it's like a beginning, and this is a continuation, and it's going to keep on going. I mean, it depends. When I think of it as positive, I don't necessarily mean what's actually happening, as opposed to the consciousness that has happened at that time, and that's what you can continue to build from. I think, yes, in terms of the consciousness and of the agency that we have and that women have, I think that there is something very positive that's happened. Obviously, in terms of all the violations that have happened, that's not a great thing. But what's positive is the fact that people have not been silent to it, and that gives me a lot of hope.
Well, that was the documentary filmmaker Hanan Abdallah with Monocle producer Daphne Denis on Abdallah's new film, In the Shadow of a Man. We're going to kind of edge round the Eastern Med now and stop off in Beirut, where we're going to hear, in song at least, from Zayd and the Wings. They're a band that we met in Ashrafia a long time ago when Monocle visited Lebanon, and they do quite a few protest songs as well. So this seems relevant for this moment. Here they are with Ocean. It's no motion. It's no motion. It's no motion. I can't escape through the railway, the city train. Well, that was Lebanon's finest, Zayd and the Wings with Ocean. Now, there's lots more happening here, but we've got about 6-8 minutes to the end of this show. But there's an important thing now, because it's the time of the day where Tom Lewis and Marcus Hippie join me in the studio. Tom is producing The Globalist Asia this evening, and Marcus is going to be presenting The Monocle Daily, and they're here to preview their shows. We'll see who's got the best one lined up. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Andrew.
We'll see if you can be as combative as Robert and James earlier on. First, though, seriously, for you, Tom, I know that you're leading with a very tough story, and this is about Golden Dawn. Could you just tell us what's been happening in Athens?
Yes, it's a grim story, Andrew, as you said. A 34-year-old man was stabbed to death in Athens. He was watching a football game with his friends in a suburb of the Greek capital. The reports are that some 30 men dressed in military trousers and tops that belonged to the Golden Dawn far-right party surrounded him. He was stabbed in the heart and in the ribs and subsequently died. Now, the man who has admitted to killing him said that he did so in the name of Golden Dawn. The party has since come out and distanced itself from this man, said he wasn't a member. But our correspondent, Natalie Savarikas in Greece, has been at a protest today in Athens, which the people there have been expressing their outrage at this. It's a worrying story because, you know, as the reports have it, the Golden Dawn party is the fastest growing political party in Greece. And that rise has really, I think you can trace to austerity in Greece, which has been debated and unpicked at some great length here on Monocle 24 and elsewhere. So Natalie spoke to one of the friends of the dead man, who gave him his reflections of who he was and just the outrage and the grief that he feels at the moment.
And was there any hint at why this gentleman was kind of picked on?
There is no hint at the moment. We believe that it seems random at the moment. He was a left-wing rapper and was quite well known in Athens, I believe. But there doesn't seem to be any personal motive that I've seen so far.
We touched on this yesterday, obviously, when we did a story about whether the kind of fissures between the kind of far right and the far left, as Greek politics seems to kind of, you know, polarise, whether it could even lead to kind of a civil war, which is something that people are already suggesting. It's a country that's certainly had its kind of ups and downs even in recent times. I presume you'll be trying to set this in some bigger context again tonight, as you say, because again, with the German elections coming up, you know, will Merkel be able to help out Athens at all? It is a kind of story that's got ramifications for all of us, isn't it?
Well, that's the concern, I think. And I think that's the concern in Greece specifically. But, you know, as you say, broader issues and more serious and sinister developments in a society can often begin with something isolated and something equally grim, but something that's quite small scale. So I think that's what we will be looking at later on the Globalist Asia, just to see, with all the upheavals in Greek society, what this might mean for other countries in Europe that are going through equally tough times.
And Marcus, you've got a slightly slightly different story. You've got a story about Chinese tourism. I quoted a fact earlier today, which I hope is true, that 7,000 Chinese people every day go on a plane for the first time. There's so many people from China travelling abroad.
That's quite astonishing, isn't it?
Every country wants them because they want their cash. But actually, when they get there, they're not quite sure that they're behaving in the way that Western tourists do. And some people are being a bit sniffy about it.
Exactly, that's true. There's even been reports from China. Do you remember that it was mentioned that China may do something to try to educate and train the tourists before they go abroad so that they would behave a bit better, not to spit on the streets and so on. Do you remember that one incident when a relatively young Chinese kid drew something in Egypt?
That's right. He kind of scratched his name, I was here.
Was it in Luxor?
That's right. Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about, it's been quite a lottery win for the Umbria region of Italy. They managed to attract Chinese television show supermodels over there to record, to film quite a few
Chinese
episodes.
Supermodels.
Chinese supermodels, indeed, to film quite a few episodes of that program. It's going to be shown in Chinese TV, and obviously it's going to attract loads of Chinese tourists to go to Italy. Then we're going to be talking about basically the pros and cons of attracting Chinese tourists and what to.
And it's also interesting because, you know, all those big Italian fashion houses are very dependent on the Chinese market as well. So I presume they'll be nipping into the sales shops while they're in Florence as well.
So that's kind of a self-esteem story, considering that Chinese tourists are indeed that wanted. We're going to talk about Italian self-esteem as well. At the same time, when the work around Costa Concordia is progressing, we are going to be talking about what that accident has done to the Italian self-esteem and what the reaction has
symbolically been. Symbolically, the raising of the ship has kind of been associated with the economy, with the national psyche. You know, can the country get itself, you know, back afloat almost?
Exactly. And anyway, when you think how much attention that place in Italy has been receiving, so that's quite astonishing, and how they've been watching that almost sunken ship for such a long time, I think it's a good question to talk about self-esteem. So
okay,
that's two stories from the programme. Plenty more coming up, obviously.
You both did very well. I think I'm going to be tuned in the whole night. That was, of course, Marcus Hippie, who is going to be presenting the Monocle Daily. And that was also Tom Lewis, who's producing The Globalist Asia tonight. And that's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Robert Fox of the Evening Standard and Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. We talked through the latest wrangling over Syria's chemical weapons supply. Here's a bit of what James had to say.
I think most people in the West would have read the headlines, you know, the UN finds chemical weapons were used, you know, follow up by, oh, and by the way, Pope still Catholic. I mean, it's just remarkable.
Now, if you want to hear more of that, of course, you can go to monocle.com or you can go to iTunes to download it. But today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmanich and Ilias Simos. And our studio manager was Bill Loiti. Next, after the headlines, it's The Entrepreneurs. And here's a little bite-sized snack of that show as well.
8 out of 10 people will start the journey out of Asia. And that means that is the future competitiveness with, first of all, the Asians. So you have to compete on a playing level field with the Asian carriers.
And if you want to know what they're actually talking about, you have to listen to the whole show. Then at 2000 hours London time, we'll have The Globalist Asia. And then 2200 hours, it is, of course, with Marcus Hippie, The Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, coming here from Midori House and also from the cafe of this issue of the Aperitivo. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.